Okay. How could you have a war even though no one wants it? There's an answer to that question. You could have a war that no one wanted, an inadvertent war, as it was called in the literature, because of the workings of the military system. So the stuff going on within the military sphere, these dynamics that would be well up from within the military sphere during a time of crisis, it could overwhelm the political leadership and bring on a war that nobody wanted. And therefore, if you wanted to prevent a war in the nuclear age, what you had to do is tinker with, you know, reshape the structure of the military system so that these dynamics didn't come into play, didn't bring on a war that nobody wanted. So this whole theory about how the incentive to go first, the incentive to preempt, because it would be so much better to go first than to only retaliate after you received a first strike. If there was a real incentive to go first, well, that could bring on a war that nobody wanted. It's like a very, very important argument about why there is the kind of an autonomous risk of war in a crisis, that the decision to go to war didn't depend on, you know, conscious political decisions made coolly and deliberately, but the political leadership, you know, just was overwhelmed, didn't have any control, was stampeded into a war. Or say, well, you know, if true, this would have been quite extraordinary. You know, among other things, it means that, here we think we have this democracy and we elect these political leaders and the political leadership is responsible, make these decisions in a very prudent, careful way, and so on. But if it turns out that the ability of political leaders to control the course of events is very limited and that our fate is essentially decided by these dynamics, you know, innate to the military sphere that we could scarcely control, well, that's extraordinarily important. It would be very, very scary if that were the case. It means we wouldn't have any real control over our destiny. On these fundamental issues of war and peace, democracy is essentially a sham, doesn't count for anything. You know, so it was a very important theory. And he said, well, what's the basis of this theory? Does it have any empirical basis at all? And the answer is, yeah, that theory rested to a quite extraordinary extent on a particular interpretation of a single historical episode, the July crisis in 1914. One of the writers who made this argument, Paul Bracken, he says, well, you know, it would be hard to believe that a nuclear war could come in this way, even though no one wants it, except for the fact that you look at what happened in 1914, and that's exactly what happened in 1914. I'll give you another example of this kind of argument. It's from Thomas Schelling. How many of you have heard of Thomas Schelling? Just a handful. Thomas Schelling is the premier strategic thinker of the late 20th century. Very, very important theorists of these issues having to do with nuclear weapons, what's called deterrence theory, very famous book. All this stuff is very accessible, by the way. And if you ever get a chance, you should take a look at it. He wrote this book called Arms and Influence. You know, it's basically a theory of how diplomacy works in the nuclear age. And he has a chapter in that book called The Dynamics of Mutual Alarm, you know, about how, you know, the political cause for war might be fairly slight, but because of this incentive to go first, this incentive to preempt, what Schelling called the reciprocal fear of surprise attack, the dynamics of mutual alarm, I call it the logic of preemption, you could have a war that scarcely makes sense in political terms. You know, each side wants to get in the first blow, or at least it wants to prevent its adversary from getting in the first blow. It knows its adversary is making that same kind of calculation about it, And so it knows its adversary is yet even more inclined to go first. And therefore, it has to, you know, be more inclined to go first. And the adversary knows that, and we know that the adversary knows that, and so on and so on and so on. That whole dynamic can bring on a war that nobody wants, even though the political cost for it is fairly slight. That's why crises are so dangerous, according to Schelling. Say, well, what's the proof he gave? You look at that chapter in that book, Arms and Influence, the Dynamics of Mutual Alarm chapter. He begins with this whole discussion of how war came in 1914. Right? And when Schelling was writing, there was a very famous book that that was like on the bestseller list when it came out in 1962, played an important role in shaping President Kennedy's thinking during the Cuban Missile Crisis. This book is called The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, bestseller. And here's how Barbara Tuchman put the issue in the introduction to her section dealing with the outbreak of the war. It's the final paragraph in her introduction. She says, "War pressed against every frontier. Suddenly dismayed, governments struggled and twisted to fend it off. There was no use. Agents at frontiers were reporting every cavalry patrol as a deployment to beat the mobilization gun. General staffs, goaded by their relentless timetables, were pounding the table for the signal to move, lest their opponents gain an hour's head start. Appalled upon the brink, the chiefs of state, who would be ultimately responsible for their country's fate, attempted to back away, but the pull of military schedules dragged them forward." Right? Very common ideas. We don't have control. We got to be really concerned about what goes on in the military sphere during the crisis, during a crisis, because it could easily lead to a war that nobody wants. It overwhelms political considerations, all this military stuff. You could have an inadvertent war in the nuclear age, just as you had it in 1914. Very important arguments. Okay? Well, are they valid? In particular, is the account of the July crisis that serves as the one empirical support for this theory, is this valid? Well, how would you get at that? If you're interested in getting at that, how would you do it? Remember I asked you a question like this in the first lecture? How would you go about getting to the bottom of this kind of issue? To see whether that theory that the First World War came about for those reasons is valid. Okay? Think about it a bit. There's an answer. The answer has to do with a basic point about method. And this is the idea that you want to get these guys, the people who make these arguments, to do your work for you, to do the heavy lifting. To make their case. You're essentially a juror, and you're examining how well the prosecutor is making his or her case. Okay? And so your first job is to pay very close attention to what the arguments are supporting this conclusion. And then you want to examine those arguments using these two tests, the test of logic and the test of evidence. Do their arguments make sense? Are they compelling? Just thinking them through in their own terms. And then, how well supported are they by the evidence that these people who make them are themselves present? Because if there's an argument to be made, you'd expect these people are the ones who would make it. They have an interest in making it. They have an interest in convincing their readers that this is so. Right? If the evidence is there, they should present it. Okay? So that's the way to proceed. That's the way to kind of get to the bottom of this issue and reach conclusions that you yourself have some real confidence in, right? Don't forget, the goal of doing this sort of analysis is to be able to reach conclusions that you're comfortable with, so that you don't have to rely on authority. You don't have to just trust what I say, for example. You don't have to trust what you read in a book. You have to have some way of making, arriving at conclusions that are convincing to you. Some way of putting yourself in the driver's seat, right? So how do you do it? How do you, what results when you look at the arguments that are advanced to support this basic notion that the coming of the First World War in July 1914 is to be understood in terms of the military system that was in place at that time. That military factors, not political factors, played the fundamental role. Well, what are the arguments that they make, these people? So you read this literature with those questions in mind. And it turns out that the arguments break down into these three separate categories, right? I know you can't see this, but the first is this business, the rigidity of military plans. Plans can't be changed, right? They can work and only before it, one and only one way. We're stuck with this, too bad. The rigidity of military plans is one argument. The second argument has to do with what's called the cult of the offensive, the great emphasis placed by the war plans and by the militaries of that period on offensive military action, not just standing on the defensive and protecting yourself against enemy attack or enemy invasion, but moving into enemy territory as fast as you possibly can, right? Okay, reaching a rapid decision in the war, right? And then there's the third, and this is the real heart of the inadvertent war theory. This is the argument about interacting mobilizations. You know, the whole mobilization system, you know, Russia moved, and Germany moved, and France moved, and so on and so on, in terms of mobilizing. Not crossing borders, but mobilizing. This led to a war, and mobilization essentially meant war, and so on. All those kinds of arguments. What does mobilization mean? It has a very strict meaning in the literature. It doesn't just simply mean getting ready for war. It means calling up all of the reservists. And all the continental countries had universal military training, manhood military training. And after a couple of years in the army, people would go into the reserves, and then mobilization meant that the reservists would all be deployed to their units, and a lot of the units would be moved to the front, and so on. So it was really a big deal, mobilization. This is an era of mass armies. That was the lesson that all of Europe drew from Prussia's victory in the Franco-Prussian War. Prussia had an army of the sort. France had a professional army, and the Prussian army, the Prussian method, demonstrated its superiority in that war. So this was mimicked by all the other European, continental European countries. British didn't have conscription. Okay? Those are the three arguments that they make. Let's look at them one by one. We're unpacking this, looking at the arguments that people make, and seeing what to make of them. First of all, this is rigidity of military plans business. And I say there are two tests, the test of logic and the test of evidence. Let's begin with the test of logic. Why should the mere fact that military plans are rigid mean that a war is more likely than it would otherwise be? Well, what's the basis for comparison? Flexible military plans. If the plans had been more flexible, is there any reason to think that war would have been avoided? What does flexibility mean? It means that instead of being locked into essentially one and only one option for fighting a war, is European countries would have the option of fighting the war in more than one way. The main case in point has to do with Germany. Germany had a plan. This is very, very important that everyone should know about this plan. It's called the Schlieffen Plan. What was the Schlieffen Plan? It was the idea that Germany needed to reach a rapid decision in a war, because here's Germany, basically simply a continental power, fighting a war with these three great world empires, huge Russian Empire, the British Empire with its resources flung around the world, with its naval power and its command of the seas and access to all the resources of North America. France, another great imperial power, a huge empire overseas. But Germany had this one advantage. She was very efficient. And she was able to mobilize her military resources, that's to say, bring them to bear much more quickly than her opponents. And so she needed to reach a rapid decision before blockade and the great superiority and resources of the Entente powers could be brought to bear on the battlefield. And in order to do that, she had this notion that the key thing was to take advantage of the fact that Russia mobilized a lot more slowly than Germany, because the Russian infrastructure, Russian railroads, and so on, were so inferior to those of Germany. She could leave her eastern border relatively undefended, concentrate the great bulk of her forces in the west, throw them against France, knock France out of the war in a very short period of time, and then pivot around, redeploy her forces to the east so that she could deal with Russia by the time Russia had mobilized. Okay, that's the Schlieffen Plan. Emphasis on the West. And it means, among other things, that to knock France out quickly, the German army would have to move through Belgium, a country whose neutrality had been guaranteed by the powers in the 1830s following Belgian independence. Why do they have to move through Belgium? Because the Franco German frontier was heavily fortified. It was mountainous. The Vosges Mountains are there. Belgium is flat. You can move the army right through Belgium. Germans were under no illusion that this was a violation of international law, but their notion was necessity knows no law. We have to do it. Okay? Now, there's an alternative to the Schlieffen Plan that had been German policy in the 1880s. And after the war, a lot of people said it would have been better than the Schlieffen Plan. And what was this alternative? It was to stay on the defensive in the West. You know, just prevent, you know, don't go through Belgium. If the French tried to attack Germany, they couldn't go through Belgium because the British wouldn't accept that. And if the French tried attacking Germany along the Franco-German border, they would just be slaughtered, because that border was much more easily defended, and the German side was very heavily fortified. That's why the Germans took Alsace-Lorraine in 1871 to begin with, for military reasons. Stay on the defensive in the west, concentrate your forces in the east, deal with Russia. Russia is basically huge, but it's much more primitive than the Western countries, and just hammer Russia until Russia kind of throws up her hands. All right, big political advantages to fighting the war that way. Among other things, if you didn't go through Belgium, you wouldn't necessarily trigger British intervention in the war. The British government was able to mobilize its own people to fight the war by saying, oh, look how awful the Germans were, look how they violated the neutrality of Belgium, and so on. And the British had a geopolitical interest in keeping French power intact as a counterweight to Germany. If the Germans stayed on the defensive in the West, fought the war in the East, well, there would be much less of a chance that the British would intervene, or if they did intervene, they wouldn't intervene in such a massive way. Okay? Now, suppose the Germans had that option. The option of fighting the war in the East as well as in the West. Suppose they were locked into the Schlieffen Plan strategy because of the lack of an alternative. OK? Okay? What would this mean? A more flexible German strategy of that sort? Would it have made war less likely? Well, why? There are only two cases. Either the Western strategy, the Schlieffen Plan strategy, would have been better than the Eastern strategy, in which case it would be used anyway, even if the Germans had greater flexibility, in which case it wouldn't make any difference. On the other hand, if the Eastern strategy was better and put Germany in a stronger position, well, would that be any reason for the Germans to pull in their horns and pursue a more moderate policy in the crisis? You know, would they have been more likely to settle the crisis without a war if they had a better military strategy that they could have done? Well, you know, if a country is in a stronger position, it's in a better position to take a tough line. Right? So this whole notion of greater flexibility would have head off the war, which is what the rigidity of war plans argument really boils down to, doesn't hold up conceptually, right? The logic doesn't stand up. What about the test of evidence? Well, there's this one story that they tell over and over again when they're making this argument about how the rigid war plans were a cause of the war. And this is a story about what happened, you know, on the very eve of the war. This is actually at the very beginning of August, right? Just before the storm in its full fury is about to break. The German government receives word from its ambassador in London that the British are willing to stay out of the war, providing the Germans stay on the defensive in the West and fight the war only in the East. And the German political leadership is ecstatic, you know. It's like break out the champagne. This is the you know, best thing we could hope for. And so there's this meeting of the political and military leadership, and the head of the German General Staff, General von Moltke, tells the Kaiser, "Your Majesty, it cannot be done. We have one and only one plan. Doesn't matter what the British are saying now. We have no choice but to fight the war in the way the plan called for, even if it means the British are going to come in. We can't change it." And the way the story is always told is like, well, the Kaiser had no answer for this and had to back down. And the result was that you had this, you know, that these rigid military plans, you know, had a dramatic effect on German policy in the war, and locked Germany into a policy that really made no sense politically. Very, very bad. Okay? Did you have a question?
Yeah. Why did they have to be locked into that plan?
Well, it was their only plan. They had no alternative.
You
can't improvise. Right? So you're talking about millions of men and all these preparations that had been made with the railroads and supplies and so on. You can't just say, oh, well, all of our preparations have been devoted to this. Well, we'll just throw that out the window and fight in a different way. We'll just, you know, here the life of our whole nation is at the line. All this planning has been focused on that. We've worked out all these plans. We'll just junk all of that and we'll fight the war in a totally improvised way. No, it's like the argument is the Kaiser had no answer for this and gave way. Well, this shows the importance of the rigidity of military plans and shaping policy. That's the claim, right? But look at the evidence. And this evidence was available all along, by the way, since the 1920s. It's just absolutely untrue. Yes, the Germans were informed by their ambassador in London that the British might stay out of the war if the Germans fought it in the East. Yeah? And yes, General von Moltke objected that, no, it couldn't be done. We have one and only one plan. Right, but what's not true is the Kaiser had no answer for this and gave way. He did have an answer. The Kaiser and the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, they did have an answer. The answer is, we're going to do it anyway. We are going to improvise, right? It says, Mulca, in his memoir he wrote at the time, he says, I went home and cried tears of despair. I thought my heart would break. Those are, in fact, direct quotes. He was overruled. The Kaiser turned to his military aide, and since Moltke refused to transmit the orders, the Kaiser had his aide transmit the orders directly to the commanders in the field. Right. Well, the problem was that either the British changed their mind or the German ambassador in London had misunderstood things, and it turned out the British weren't going to stay out no matter how the war was fought. So the Kaiser said, okay, fight it your way. But it's quite extraordinary how the one piece of empirical evidence that's presented in these texts to support this view that the rigidity of the war plans was the cause of the war turns out not to be valid. I mean, I don't know if you're kind of shocked to hear this stuff, because here we're dealing with these fundamental issues of war and peace. The life of every person in this room kind of depends to a certain extent on how well they're dealt with. And yet, we have this culture that allows them to be dealt with in this totally shoddy way. I mean, for me, all this stuff is just so shocking. Yeah?
So, just to be clear, the Kaiser didn't want to go with the Schlieffen Plan. He wanted to try to improve.
As long as he thought that the British would stay out of the war, yes, he would improvise. If he had that guarantee. Right? Yes, he was willing to overturn this stuff. So these rigid plans weren't quite as rigid as people said. Yes?
I thought the British did guarantee that they would stay out.
What?
Didn't you say that?
I said the Germans were informed by their ambassador in London that the British were willing to do that. But it turned out that either the ambassador had been misinformed or the British changed their minds.
So they got the guarantee and just disregarded it?
No, they didn't get a guarantee because the British changed their minds.
Okay.
Or they hadn't given a guarantee in the first place, okay. Right? Okay, the second big argument is called the cult of the offensive. Remember, I was talking about the Robert Jervis article that was written when he was an assistant professor right here at UCLA. It's cooperation under the security security dilemma, and this whole notion of the security dilemma. And Jervis has this argument about what determines how sharp, how pernicious the security dilemma is. The security dilemma is this whole problem that you gotta behave aggressively for purely defensive purposes. And so even status quo-oriented powers are led to adopt these aggressive policies and the clash of aggressive policies that can bring on a war that nobody wants, really, and is not built into the basic structure of political relations among these states, right? And Jervis says, well, what determines how pernicious it is? It's this military stuff, the degree to which countries place an emphasis on offensive military action. You know, everyone opts for defensive policies, it's much easier to kind of just remain on the status quo. You're not pushed toward acting aggressively. You just will say, well, let the other guy move first. We'll just mow him down, right? But if you really feel an incentive to move offensively, even for purely defensive purposes, if offensive military action is your only chance of survival, well, that's a very dangerous situation. Then the security dilemma is very sharp, and you can have a war for those reasons. And this basic Jervis argument was like practically someone throwing a football. It was caught by another international relations theorist named Stephen Van Evra, and he wrote an important article about the cult of the offensive and the origins of the First World War. And his claim is the cult of the offensive was the key factor in bringing on war in 1914. And he makes a number of arguments to that effect, but his strongest argument has to do with what he called windows Windows of vulnerability, windows of opportunity. All right, this is another one of these phrases of art from the international relations literature. What's a window? It means if you feel that you're strong now, but the strategic balance is moving against you so that you're going to be a lot weaker later on, then you start to think, well, if war is inevitable, maybe we should have it sooner rather than later. You start to think in what I call preventive war terms. Okay? If your strategic position is good now and it's going to deteriorate later, then that means you have a window of opportunity. There's an incentive for you to act, to bring matters to a head sooner rather than later. And conversely, if things are bad for you now, but they're going to get better later, that's called a window of vulnerability. They call it a window because these things open and close, right? And if you're in a window of vulnerability, then you should play very cool and avoid getting into a war now. Okay, and the basic insight of Van Ever is that these windows open much wider. The pressures to act preventively, to bring matters to head sooner rather than later, are much greater when an emphasis is placed on offensive military action. You know, if you really think that the defense has the upper hand, you know, these shifts in the strategic balance, they don't really matter so much. It's like the adversary may be stronger, but still your forces are able to provide for your own defense, and you don't have to worry about this stuff so much. But if you think that offensive military action is crucial, and you have an offensive capability now, that if you implement your war plans now, you could win. But if you hold off for a few years, not only will you not be able to win, but you yourself are going to be, you know, totally defeated. Well, then that's an argument for bringing matters to a head sooner rather than later. So there's a connection between the emphasis placed on offense and the importance of windows of opportunity. And he says, and this is exactly what you saw in 1914. And sure enough, he goes into the sources and he shows that the Germans especially were thinking in those terms. Right? They thought that if war broke out now, they still had a good chance of winning it. But they knew that with the build-up, especially of Russian power, that by 1917, the Schlieffen plan wouldn't be viable anymore because they would have to do a whole lot more to defend their eastern border. They would have to divide their forces. The forces that they had in the west would not be sufficient to deal a knockout blow to France, no matter how fast they moved, whether they went through Belgium or not. The Schlieffen plan would no longer be viable. That's their one and only one plan. And so what this meant was they had to move now. They had to bring matters to a head now rather than later. Okay? And sure enough, there's a lot of evidence to support this. So what's the problem with the argument? The problem with the argument is that when you're analyzing these things, you have to look at both sides of the equation. Not just at the German calculations, but of the calculations of the other powers. A window of opportunity for Germany is by definition a window of vulnerability for the Entente powers. If Germany had an extra incentive to bring matters to a head now rather than later, presumably the Entente powers had exactly the opposite incentive to bring matters to a head later rather than now, to take a relatively conciliatory line now. And you see, when you look at things in systemic terms, the two sets of considerations cancel each other out. So the windows, on balance, the net effect should be zero. Right? See, let me just say that this is a problem you find in the political science literature over and over again. They actually have a name for it. You ever hear this term called cherry picking? Cherry picking means you have your theory, and then you only see things that support your own theory. So you go through all of the sources, and you pluck out all these little pieces of evidence that support your theory, and you're totally blind to things that cut in the opposite direction. But if you bring an independent critical sensibility to bear, you see the problem. Yeah?
So is the flaw in assuming your position relative to the other? In assuming
the flaw is being blind to the other, right? The flaw is just looking for stuff that supports your way of looking at things. But the logic is, if you're Germany and you have a window of opportunity here, right? The strategic balance is good for you now, it's moving against you. Well, the Entente should look at things in exactly the opposite way, right? You say, we should put things off. Those two considerations neutralize each other, cancel each other out, right? I go on. You'll see the article I wrote on this stuff. You'll see the various problems that are laid out. But I got to move on because I haven't yet touched on the heart of the inadvertent war theory, which is the whole business about interacting mobilizations. It's the mobilization system that brought on the war. You know, it's like, is it true? Well, first question is, did a system of interacting mobilizations even exist? And the answer there is, yes, it certainly did. And to understand why it existed, you have to understand not just what the Schlieffen Plan was, which I discussed before, but the logic of the general situation that was created by the Schlieffen Plan. And this is really important for everyone to understand this, because I promise you this is going to be on the midterm. No better way to get people to pay attention. What's the logic of the situation created by the Schlieffen Plan? Okay? The logic of the situation created by the Schlieffen Plan, if Russia resorts to general mobilization, you know, the calling up of all the reservists to their units and their deployment, not just against Austria, but against Germany as well, right? If Russia resorts to general mobilization, Germany has to not just mobilize herself, but actually begin the war. Why is this? Because there's this very narrow time window that the Germans have. They're capitalizing on the fact that their mobilization is just going to be so much quicker than that of Russia. And so there's only a certain limited period of time after Russia begins to mobilize that Germany could leave her eastern border relatively undefended, concentrate the bulk of her forces in the west, move through Belgium, deal the knockout blow to France, and then pivot around and be able to deal with Russia by the time the Russian mobilization is completed, and it's possible for Russia to undertake offensive military operations against Germany itself. So as soon as Russia orders mobilization, Germany has to move. Not just mobilizing herself, but begin these military operations against France. And she can't just sit on her hands while Russia mobilizes, because then she can't use the Schlieffen Plan. It's going to be this long war of attrition. Germany can't hold out against these three great world empires in a long war of attrition. She has to move fast. Okay? So Russian mobilization leads to German mobilization, which leads to an attack on France, which leads to the involvement of not just France, but of Britain as well in the war. Mobilization, Russian mobilization, by that iron logic, leads to war. It's vitally important that everyone understand this. Okay? So the system exists. Is that tantamount to saying that it was a cause of the war? Well, no. Because it has to be set off. It has to be triggered. If everyone understands how the system works, then a Russian decision to order general mobilization is a decision to start the war. It's like, everyone understands if you pull the trigger on a gun, you know, you aim it at someone, and someone is going to be murdered. You can't say that murder is a result of the whole chemical mechanism within the gun. You know, it's like if the Russians understand what they're doing, it's a decision to start a war, as much as if they had decided to invade Germany or attack German forces. Right. Yeah?
Does this mean that Russia has to be, like, submissive, almost?
Why?
Because if they don't mobilize, they're only allowed to mobilize if they want to start a war?
If they're only allowed to mobilize? It means that if they mobilize, it's tantamount to war. If they don't want to go to war, then they shouldn't mobilize. If they're willing to go to war, then they mobilize. Doesn't mean that someone says, "Oh, you're not allowed to mobilize." It's just saying you should be aware of what the implications are. If you're willing to go to war for the sake of Serbia, mobilize. But you should understand that you're essentially starting a war. All right. So, for the inadvertent war theory to hold, one of two things has to be true. Either the Russians didn't know what they were doing, didn't understand the logic of the system, didn't understand what the implications of a general mobilization were, or they were under such pressure to act, whether they understood the implications or not, that they were essentially stampeded into the war. That the political leadership was no longer in control, that political considerations were no longer in the driver's seat, and the Russian leadership was pretty much forced to do what it did because of pressures welling up from within the military sphere, right? Because if everyone understood what the mechanism was, and the political leadership was making these decisions free of those kinds of pressures, if the political leadership were free agents, you can't say the mobilization system was the cause of the war. The war is being begun for political reasons. The Russians are making this move totally aware of what the implications are. So if you look at the literature and the people who want to say the mobilization system was the cause of the war, their arguments basically break down into those two categories. So a lot of people say, oh, they didn't understand what they were doing. And some people say, well, whether they understood it or not, they were under such pressure to act. You know, generals slamming their fist on the table and so on, the Barbara Tuchman quote, that they had no choice, right? And so now we've unpacked it, and we could look at whether those arguments hold up in the light of the evidence. All right? And in the 2 minutes I have remaining, let me just say that, no, they don't hold up. This is one of these things that's quite shocking. After the Bolshevik Revolution, the Bolsheviks went into the Tsarist archives and they published the records of these meetings at which the Russian decision for general mobilization on July 30th, 1914 were made. This is the Russian decision for general mobilization. This triggered the Schlieffen Plan, led to the attack on France through Belgium, led to the outbreak of the war. Did the Russians know what they were doing? You're damn right they knew what they were doing. It's very, very clear from the records of the meeting at which the decision was made. You know? Were they under such pressure from within the military sphere, that from generals banging their fists on the table, that they felt they had to do this? Answer there, no. Why is this the case? Because unlike the picture you get from Schelling and these people who talk about preemption, everyone wanting to preempt, the Germans did not have a first strike strategy, the equivalent of a first strike strategy. The Germans were determined to allow Russia to be the first to mobilize. The Germans made that decision for political reasons. Because for two considerations, they wanted to convincingly argue to their own people that this is a purely defensive war, and that it's Russia that's responsible for the war, so that they can mobilize the energies of their own people. And then two, they wanted to have a better chance of keeping the British out of the war by making it clear to everybody that Russia was the one that took the most decisive step here, right? All this stuff was common knowledge. You look at these records of the Russian meetings, they're not saying, we got to move because Germany is about to move. It's like, we got to move for political reasons because the Central Powers are determined to crush Serbia, right? And we're determined to not let that happen. And that we're a match, we with our allies are a match for Germany. We should go to war over this issue. The decision was made for political reasons, not for military reasons. The mobilization system, interactive mobilization system, it existed, but it was not the cause of the war. Okay? A very important conclusion, given the degree to which so many political scientists have argued that all of this military stuff played the crucial role in bringing on the war. Okay, so I'm out of time here for today. Next time we're going to deal with American entry into the war in 1917.